Hello, and thank you for listening to episode 3 of 60 Minutes With. I'm Dave, and I'm back with another interview show. And this week I'm going to be talking to a guy who was a tour manager. He spent most of his time during the 70s and 80s doing that, including working with such bands as Cockney Rebel, Duran Duran, Fleetwood Mac, The Grateful Dead, Wishbone Ash, the list goes on. You're in for a treat because you're going to hear some great stories. Some of them include what a band threw a hotel window as an alternative to a television, and also a little story about polishing a spaceship. So make of that what you will. This guy has also got a fantastic website. I do gush about it at the end of the 60 minutes, and rightfully so, because trust me, it's a website that is worth going to. You can go to roadstories.co.uk. There's free content on there. There's also a premium service, and like I say at the end of the interview, for the price that it is, it beats any Black Friday deal that happened this weekend. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy as I spend 60 minutes with Richard Amis. Right, Richard, I think the first thing that the listeners would love to know, I'm sure they've heard of the term tour manager. Can you explain, please, what a tour manager is and what a tour manager does?
Okay. A tour manager is hired normally by the band's management to take the band on tour, be dad, so to speak, on tour, but most importantly, set up the production schedules for the tour in advance. And the secret to doing a good job as a tour manager is the preparation before the tour. And in the olden days, so to speak, in the 70s and early 80s, a tour manager, however large the tour was the guy in charge of hiring the sound company, the light company, this trucking. When buses were introduced, buses and transport in general. Also, working closely with the travel agent to organise all the flights, trains, hotels, etc., etc. So, in all, an organiser that sets up everything necessary in advance that is needed to do a tour. In later years, in the mid 80s, really, the production manager or the became an important part of a slightly larger organisation. Mm-hmm. And took over a lot of the technical roles.
Yeah.
That a tour manager used to do. The tour manager also used to do the settlements with the promoters at the end of the gig, so look after the money, run the accounts for the tour, and most importantly, I suppose, on tour, travelled with the band wherever they went and organised their daily schedule.
Wow. I mean, that's a hell of a lot of work right from the off, from when you first get note of, okay, you're going to be the tour manager for this band on this tour. How far in advance normally, let's go back, say, into the 70s, how far in advance before the tour started would you have to start work on that tour?
It was a lot less time back then than it is now. And that's really mainly because the tour or the touring schedules nowadays you see shows that are going to go on sale now for next October.
Yeah.
For some of the big bands. You didn't used to see that in the 70s. It was always about 3 months in advance. Sometimes even closer than that, but depending on the popularity and the rise, so to speak, of the act. It brings to mind Duran Duran in America when we were touring round for their second time. It was my first time with them, round fairly large clubs, but nothing bigger than that. Mm-hmm. When they started to have a lot of radio play, and then all of a sudden there was a lot of demand by the American promoters, and so we were literally booking shows while we're on the road, and that was literally 1 month ahead of time, so to speak. But generally, back to your question, in the 70s, we'd be booking about 2 months.
Yeah.
2 months ahead, in a live schedule, and then setting up soon as we knew. What used to happen, because it was fly by the pants sort of scenario in the 70s, you didn't have sleeper buses, which became a very, very important factor in heavy duty touring, really. Before sleeper buses, crews had to get from one show to the other, obviously.
Yeah.
But they needed sleep between the two. So back in those days, you couldn't do Brighton to Glasgow back to back, because you couldn't physically get there.
Yeah, of course.
Whereas now, with sleeper buses, the crew, you know, jump on the bus at midnight. If they're good boys, they're in bed tucked up. And they're woken up again at 9:10 in the morning in Glasgow. Obviously, in the 70s, that couldn't happen. So the tour manager and the agent who booked the shows for the band or for the bands worked very closely with the tour manager in making sure that physically and practically one could get from one place to to the other.
Yeah.
You know, there's an old saying of tour managers, I think, that we think most agents actually are blind. They actually do book dates with the dartboard. And you look at a schedule even now and you're going, why are they going Brighton, Glasgow, and then back to Bournemouth?
Yeah.
I to this day, Dave, I don't know why.
It's weird, isn't it? It's weird.
I think it's called dyslexia or laziness.
You mentioned as well, you know, when you're out on the road with Duran Duran then, and they were getting more popular as you were out on the road with them. This, of course, for anybody listening that may be of a certain age and that younger than both myself and Richard, this was like pre-internet. So how was the logistics of that off? Was it like all phone calls then, was it?
Everything was by phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. No mobile phones.
Yeah, exactly.
No computers. There was the telex, but the telex was really used for international purposes, and you could only find telexes in major hotels or in the offices of the big agencies, so to speak, or promoters. But no, by telephone. Yep, the whole thing. Either by telephone or, if one was lucky enough to be based, I was based in London through the 70s and 80s, and I worked for the most part for UK acts, and so their agents were London-based, and quite often the production companies were London-based, so one could actually do logistically, and the travel agent was based in London as well, so it was face to face.
Yeah.
Yes, as long as you had enough time, it was face to face meetings around a table with pen and paper, really, and just bashing things out that way. The telephone really came into its own once you were on the road, and the hotel room telephone bill was more often than not more expensive than the room itself.
Oh no. I've got to ask, have you ever, during the years when you're on the road with bands, have you ever seen the classic, a TV thrown from the hotel window?
No, but something does come to mind.
Oh right, I'm intrigued now.
The only projectiles I can actually recall was on a Cockney Rebel tour, and I had a very bizarre job before I joined the music business, working for a Chingford, North London-based company called London Rubber Company, and they were manufacturers of rubber products, most famously Durex and Marigold rubber gloves. And for overseas people listening, Durex was the prophylactic of choice for the gentlemen of the UK in these days. And working for them, I worked for them as a management trainee. So, as part of that 2 year or 18 month time with them, I was a merchandiser. And I collected quite a lot of free samples during my period with them. Flash forward to Cockney Rebel, and I've got a few Durex in my suitcase. And it's after a show in a Holiday Inn. And I'm not sure whether it was Plymouth or Bristol, but it was one of those two. And we were in a suite after the show, having a few drinks, as one usually did. I don't know how it happened, but Durex were brought out and rather a large amount of water poured into them to become a water balloon. And then a couple of the band started chucking them out the window. They were landing in the flower beds at the front of the hotel, and about 10 minutes after this started, I got a phone call from reception going, "Miss James, I've got to tell you, I believe some of your party is throwing mud out the window. We've had several people come in covered in mud." Cried. Do you really think people would throw mud out of the window? Yes, that's the projectile I've.
You could have offered them the marigolds then to clean themselves up with, couldn't you? How did you get then? What was the progression from working at this rubber company to, like, for your first tour as a road manager? What happened in between to give you that transition?
Well, I very early on in the management trainee cycle, I met a chap in the canteen with hair down past his shoulders, who was working in the labs in the company by the name of John Crocker, and as we started getting to know each other, we were a similar age, and we were probably one of the youngest. Couple of guys in the factory at that time. John was a folk musician sleeping on someone's sofa in a block of flats quite near the factory, and this was his day job. And I, as I said, was a management trainee, living in digs that I'd found before moving from my hometown in Oxford at the end of my final school year, to this first job. And I was looking to move out of the digs. John was looking to move off of the sofa. So we decided to look for a flat together. And we ended up sharing a single room above a woman's hairdresser's in Walthamstow. And one of his muso friends crashed out one night, and I met him. His name was Steve. His name was Steve Nice, and he changed his name to Steve Harley.
Ah, okay.
Steve Harley and John Crocker, who created Cockney Rebel. And I, as John's best friend at the time, and to this day as well, used to hang around. There's always a guy that hung around with the players, and I watched the band being auditioned to the point of a record deal, I used to go down in the evenings and watch rehearsals and stuff. And when they got given a record deal with EMI, it was at the end of my management trainee course, and I decided to take a year off, take off the suit and tie, put on the jeans and t-shirt, because they offered me a full-time job as the road manager for, i.e. the roadie, for the band, for as much money as I was earning at London Rubber at the time, which was 15 quid a week.
Wow.
And in fact, they offered more. I got offered, well, I got paid by Cotton Roll £15 a week and £5 a gig. So on a good week, I was, yes, I was earning quite a nice little lump for 1974.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's how it all kicked off, really. And I didn't go back after a year. It launched me into the live music scene, and I just went forward from there.
So, Cole, you worked in at the start, obviously, then, like you said, with Cockney Rebel, and you saw them just rise and rise like they did all through the 70s.
Yes.
That must have been such an exciting time then.
Absolutely. It was crazy. It was the ultimate sort of freedom that I is what I recall as looking back now, of being free as a bird, really, and just and every time you went out to earn money, you went to a place where everyone was having fun, you know, out for a good time, and I was one of the few in the room getting paid. Happy days.
That's a win-win situation if ever there was one.
Absolutely. And I started as the roadie and the sound engineer, and fortunately the group got quite popular quite quickly, needing really a tour manager, and so we got in a proper sound engineer. I joined the band as the tour manager, and it went from there, really. I was very fortunate because at the same time, I somehow got involved with Harvey Goldsmith. And Harvey took me under his wing and used to hire me for one-off events. And through working with Harvey Goldsmith in London, when I wasn't working with Cockney Rebel, I got my name about, and more things and opportunities came my way. It was very fortunate.
I mean, because you've worked with such a hell of a lot of bands and artists, have you ever been, I was going to say intimidated, but that's the wrong word, have you ever been awestruck by anybody when you've met them, even though you're in the business? Has anybody had that effect on you?
Only once. Only once. It was fleeting in a way, because it's very hard to describe, but when you are one of them, so to speak, there is a comfort zone. But I was hired by Harvey Goldsmith to help tour manage a Wings tour. In fact, it's supposed to be a Wings World tour. And I remember getting introduced to Paul McCartney at the Rainbow Theatre, where they were using for rehearsals, and that was probably the most nervous I'd ever been in front of someone that I got to know a little bit, and he and Linda were very nice and kind to me.
It must be good in situations like that as well, you know, when you meet somebody who's so big within the business, and they are really nice, because there's, you know, I'm sure that the opposite, and I'm not going to ask you to name names, but I'm sure there's been the opposite at times when people haven't been quite so nice to you, surely.
Very fortunate. Very fortunately, there's only a couple that come to mind, really, over a 40-year period. No, I've been really lucky, actually, with the people I've worked with. And I think, you're right to say, for the most part, most people in the business are nice, and down to earth and normal. They've just got a strange job where, you know, certain part of the day they're in the spotlight.
Yeah. I know, like, we've gone, like, from the early 70s with Cockney Rebel, and you're with them right the way through the 70s. What was the next band, then, that you had to do a lot of work with as a Rhodes manager after Cockney Rebel, and while you were still with Cockney Rebel?
Well, the next band I actually worked with, the first band I worked with during Cockney Rebel, I wasn't actually the road manager. I was the assistant to the road manager with Wishbone Ash. And I got offered a job as basically the baggage boy for an American tour through Miles Copeland, and who was managing Wishbone Ash at the time. But and that was amazing.
Yeah.
That was... Because they were my schoolboy heroes, so here I am getting paid to look after my schoolboy heroes, which was an amazing buzz. Apart from the fact that I just loved the music as well, but as a road manager, I think the Fleetwood Mac Rumours tour is probably the big one. While still with Cockney Rebel, although I think I've just started moving away from working full time for them in 77, and I got asked by Barry Dickens, who is still a promoter and an agent, but he headed a big agency called MAM, M-A-M, who bought Fleetwood Mac into the UK and promoted the original Rumours tour of the UK. And yeah, it was my job to then, they had their own tour manager because they were based in America anyway, but an English guy called John Courage. But I was in charge of making sure every show was up and running, and everything they needed got done.
I mean, that's a hell of a big tour as well. There must have been so much to organise on it.
It was, in those early days, it was theatres for the most part. We were playing theatres or cinemas, so like the Hammersmith Odeon, the Birmingham Odeon as it was then, and Newcastle City Hall. So 2,000-3,000 capacity venues. They didn't have anything in them, so everything was brought in. It was the first time that tours were using Arctic trailers and having lighting systems put into buildings,
so yeah.
As well as the sound systems and all the stage gear. So the venues had a certain amount of infrastructure. They had rooms for dressing rooms, but you had to put stuff into the, or organise putting stuff into the dressing rooms. They had the electricity, but you had to organise electricians to connect everything together for the group. You had parking to arrange because you had these big trucks parking in city centres, and then. You had catering to sometimes to organise if they weren't travelling with their own caterers. So it was there was a list that, you know, that you ticked off, and it was a pretty common list that that went through the 70s, playing these sorts of venues.
Yeah,
and you know, and as the venues get larger, the list just changes, you know, a little bit. Mm. And normally a few more people are involved than in smaller venues.
You mentioned catering then as well. Just following on from that a bit, we've all heard stories about some band's rider, the infamous rider list, and there's all these weird stories of different things that bands demand and so on. And again, you know, you don't have to say any artist's name, but what's the weirdest thing or things that bands have put onto the rider that you know of?
There isn't any, really.
Really? Oh, I'm having visions of there has to be a zebra with a dress on and you know, this old Smarties with all the orange ones taken out and all this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's all been blown a bit out of proportion, really. I hate to disillusion you here, Dave, but no, with the big artists that I've worked in from a promoter's point of view, nothing really sort of comes to mind. The funniest thing I've ever been asked was on Nat Rumour's Fleetwood Mac tour, which did sort of throw me slightly, and it was up the first show, and John Courage came up to me and said, just before soundcheck, he said, "Rich, can you organise, Mick needs a couple of pairs of extra long black ballet tights." And I couldn't quite believe what he was asking. And obviously in the back of my mind, I'm going, where the hell am I going to do in Birmingham?
Oh, yeah.
And the gods were looking down on me, I tell you, because actually, if you, and he wore them during the show, and I think if you look at the Rumours album sleeve, he's in them, posing on the front cover.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And I walked out of the backstage of the Birmingham Odeon up towards the what's the famous roundabout, the Boring.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go to the Boring and just ask, you know, where maybe I could get something like this. I don't know, a Debenhams or a, hell, you know, what shall I go? Anyway, I'm stood on the road in the cold, looking across the roundabout, and I tell no lie, opposite, I'm staring at a ballet shop.
Oh, my word.
And I walk round the roundabout into the ballet shop and buy two pairs of extra long black ballet tights. Happy days. So I walked back and mission accomplished. And I thought it was going to be a lot harder than that.
That just shows how damn good you are at your job, Richard, doesn't it?
No, it was fate, Dave. It was just a lucky day. Definitely a lucky day.
Yeah. Oh. So you're in Birmingham, you've travelled the UK, obviously. Where's some of the favourite places that you visited in the world then with the job? It's obviously taken you in a lot of different places. Where's some of the best places that you've been to? And for what reason when you've been there?
Were you talking in the early days?
Anytime at all.
I've had a couple of really, really nice off-the-wall... I mean, recently I've actually... I'm semi-retired now, but I still do go out and do some special projects. And in 2011, I was asked to be world tour director for a couple of really big Japanese bands. And so I got to go to Shanghai a couple of times.
Oh, lovely.
And as well as Japan. And Shanghai was an incredibly interesting place. It's just growing so quickly. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. Back in the early days, one of the strangest, if not the strangest place I've ever done a gig was working for the Grateful Dead and being asked to get all their production to the Great Pyramids in Cairo in Egypt.
Whoa, my.
The shows they did in front of the pyramids there. And so I ended up, camped next to the, in a fantastic hotel I've got to recommend to anyone who goes to Egypt, the Mena House Hotel, right next to the Great Pyramid. And got to camp in there for 3 weeks, setting up those three shows back in September 1978. And another weird one I got asked to do, which never came off, was I got asked to organise a continental tour of South America for Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. And it wasn't the first time a band had ever been down there, because the likes of Yes had been down there, and I think Zeppelin had also been down there. But I'm talking 1977.
Yeah.
And I got the job of going down there and setting it all up, this Ritchie Blackmore Continental Tour. So I went around the whole of South America, getting met by each promoter in each capital city, checking out the production, figuring out how we're going to do, Argentina, Brazil to Uruguay to Chile to Argentina, and routing it and setting that whole thing up. And as we discussed earlier, there wasn't anything like laptops or mobile phones, so it was quite a slow process.
Yeah.
I ended up over there for about a month, 5 weeks, just setting the whole thing up. And then I came back, having set it all up, and things like, okay, for the Uruguayan show, we're going to bring the production from Brazil. For the Chile show, we'll take production from Argentina up across to Santiago, and things like that. And I got back and laid out my plans. And then they said, could you just move it a month?
Oh, no. As if it would be that easy. You just shift everything along.
That's sort of what I said, though. and so the telex machine became my best friend for the next week while you're trying to reschedule all these. And we were playing either large arenas, tennis courts, or football fields. Football stadiums, because Deep Purple had been huge down there in the 70s, and Ritchie Blackmore, rightfully, as the main lead guitar player, was also huge down there. And so, yeah, I managed to, by telex, just change the whole routing, and then in the end they cancelled it altogether. They thought it was too close to their North American tour, and they got scared, in actual fact. They were a bit worried, with all the politics and that go on down there and everything. And
yeah.
And they thought it was too risky. So I don't know whether they actually tried to get insurance or whatever, but in the end it all got canned. But very interesting time from my point of view, given quite a lot of responsibility at the ripe old age of 24, I think I was.
Oh, wow, yeah. God, that's a hell of a lot of responsibility.
Going around some fantastic countries, meeting some very interesting people. And I've got to say that everyone down there at the time, it was very, very early days for them to be putting on these sorts of big shows. And it was interesting being a part of it back then.
Did that happen? Well, I'm hoping it didn't happen too often, where you'd put all this, all the pre-production work into it, and then it was cancelled.
No, only a couple of times. The Grateful Dead one was cancelled. Actually, I got hired originally by them to set up a European tour, and which I did. But just before, or as I was setting it up, they said we're going to play in Egypt. So, can you get all the production we're going to use in Europe to the pyramids? And it was when I got the production to the pyramids and they flew in that they said that we're not actually going to do the European tour.
Oh.
So, yeah, we'd booked everything. We'd got out hotels and the whole kit and caboodle organised for a European tour. And I'm staring as I speak to you, actually, on my wall at a huge poster I've got of the Grateful Dead European Tour 1978, And it's supposed to Harvey Goldsmith made up because he was the promoter for London, and they were supposed to play three nights at the Rainbow Theatre, and they never came over to do them.
Oh no.
It was all blown.
And when you're out on the road with these bands as well, what sort of time limit? Because we always think, bands come in, they do the gig, then you've got to travel to the next one, you've got to set it all up. There must be a lot of time where you don't have the time to see where the gig is, but you've got time to fill in between the gigs. It must get, although we see, we think it's all glitz and glamour, it must get quite boring at times too, surely.
I don't think you have time to get bored, to be quite honest. It's rest days are just are literally at that. And I recall in America, my favorite pastime when I had a day off wasn't particularly to go out and try and look around a town or a city. I'd much prefer to just order room service and watch American football games,
That sounds good to me.
just do and doze and just yeah and just recharge the batteries, really. So no, it's, I think when you've got, I've done it recently. I did a world tour for with Supertramp. And we were fortunate enough to have our own private jet. So having our own jet enabled us not to have to travel each day, which meant that one could base oneself in a city and then fly off and fly back each show day, which then allowed you time in a place to get to know it a little bit better. And we spent over a couple of weeks in Paris for the European tour, and in Canada we spent 10 days in Vancouver and 10 days in Toronto. So it was on a day off you could have a good look around, go around a couple of museums, walk around some parks and that sort of stuff.
I mean, just those two words, private jet. I mean, they, going back to you when you were working for the London Rubber, that if you could give yourself some information from then to now, it must have been so weird to go from that, and then here you are on this private jet that most people just sort of dream of even seeing, never mind going on. It's it's incredible, isn't it, when you look back on it?
No, I absolutely. And it's interesting in the pub, and you come back home and you're chatting in the pub, and okay, how did it go, Richard? And you just say, well, first thing I have to do is have a bit of breakfast and then call the pilot and tell them what time I'll take off. Dave, someone's got to do it.
Yes, and why not? It may as well be you, Richard. Why not?
It does have its own set of problems, though. You one would think, from a travel point of view, it's wonderful. It saves you an awful lot of stress and traveling. But it has its own little idiosyncrasies because, unlike commercial aircraft who have slots in airports, and you read about BA or Virgin Airlines swapping slots and sometimes for millions of pounds to be able to be guaranteed a takeoff and a landing slot. A private jet, though, takes off and lands at the same airports but does not have those slots. So it's a bit nerve-wracking sometimes, having to find out in advance that one can take off, one can land, and especially in the evenings. In the evenings after a show, if you want to fly back, can you take off at 11 o'clock at night from wherever you're doing the show? And will the airport still be open where you're flying back to?
Oh, yeah.
So the logistics of a private jet are, yeah, have their own certain limitations to a certain extent. You'd think it was, you know, completely, oh, whatever you want, sir, but it's not actually the case sometimes. And it was, yeah, you have to be careful where you base yourself, really, because some airports, if the private jet control people can't guarantee you a departure time, then avoid that airfield because, you know, you won't make the gig.
Well, has there ever been any close calls due to that happening? Although
yeah.
I'm sure, I was going to say, I'm sure you're far too organised to make that happen.
well, yes. One tries to organise that sort of travel with the fact that you've got, you know, limousines picking you up at X time after 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and so it's everything's very precise, you know, or one tries to get it very precise. So there's no hanging around anywhere, and when you get strikes, we were based in Paris, and there's a couple of times they went on strike, and yeah, we were sat in the lounge for an hour and a half, sweating, you know, sweating it out that we'd be able to take off. But hey ho.
Luckily, yeah. You did. Luckily, you did.
That all worked out.
Good. Well, there's two. I've got two artists I have to ask you about, and the first one is one of my all-time favourite bands, ELO. Now, you worked with ELO in the 70s. I mean, and they put on a hell of a stage show then, that's for sure.
Yes, at the time, I was up on the periphery of this. I was actually on the US segment of the ELO spaceship tour, as it's probably known.
Yeah.
This spaceship built in Britain, built by the production company that took them around the world, a company called Tasco, based in London. It was the Sharon Osbourne's dad who was managing them at the time.
Oh, okay.
And he wanted a production that sort of tied in with the album and the album artwork. And so they ended up deciding to build this this spaceship. And did you see it?
I didn't, unfortunately. I mean, I loved the band at that time. I think I got into ELO about 77.
Did you see the gig recently at Hyde Park?
I didn't know. I wanted to go and I couldn't get down there.
Oh, it was simulcast on the internet. It was amazing.
Oh, I mean, I've seen the footage of it online, but you know, right. I would so have loved to have been there and see them live. It's one of those bands that I have to see live before I die. I really have to.
Well, I mean, with a bit of luck, he'll be touring that again, I would imagine. But yes, I was. I digressed really. I was actually out in America, doing some research into merchandising. I had been given the opportunity to set up a big merchandising company in the UK to service Europe, because it was all very itty-bitty in the mid-70s, and there was a formulation of a couple of companies in America because it was such big business. And I got through Harvey Goldsmith, who was a partner in one of the big companies in America called Brocken. I got the opportunity to go on the road for a couple of weeks to see how it was really done big time. And so I started off on the first day of the ELO tour and sat with it for 2 weeks. And the shows themselves were fantastic. The staging took they had to start, I think, at midnight, a midnight loading, which was pretty tight even in those days. It might have even taken 2 days. I can't remember now, to build this spaceship inside the arena.
Oh my!
It sat there before the show started, looking like a huge McDonald's hamburger. And as the light went down, the top half rose up on chain hoists, and then the band appeared through the floor, through lifts, onto the center of the bottom section of the burger, so to speak, with lights and lasers and all that good stuff. I'm going to tell you a funny story about this spaceship, because I recently, actually, for another project I'm doing, I'm interviewing some of the original people that started UK production companies in the early 70s. And one of the guys I interviewed was the guy that set up Tasco. And I reminded him about the spaceship tour, and he told me a very funny story about the American tour there. And there was this one guy who was in charge of keeping the spaceship clean. And so every day in America, pretty much, he'd have to go to a hardware store somewhere and buy a complete box of Pledge spray, you know, spray polish.
Yeah.
And so, inevitably, the guy at the store would say, "Well, why do you need so much polish?" And his reply was, "Clean my spaceship." I wish I could have been a fly on the wall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I wonder, I bet he got some good responses back to that one. Oh, that's good. It's not very often you're going to hear that, is it? You're going to clean your spaceship.
Back in his hometown, how did your job go? He says, you just clean my spaceship every day. It was a sight to behold. It was huge. It was actually huge.
Just from the videos, it just looks so spectacular.
Yes.
The other artist I've got to ask you as well, because I was lucky enough a few months ago to see Kate Bush, who returned to the stage after a long, long break.
Hang on a sec, Dave.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm just remembering another just story about ELO. Which is quite interesting. So I'm on the merchandising team, the official merchandising team, and as I said, it's big business over there. And here's a problem: you don't think. In fact, it probably wouldn't be a problem in Europe, but it was definitely a problem in America, and that was banking the money.
Ah, of course, yeah.
So every night it's $20,000 or more was taken in cash. And if it was a weekend, by the end of the weekend, you'd have, up to $60,000 to bank, to get in the banking system. And in America, you couldn't bank more than $10,000 in any bank without filling out a yard of forms. And you just didn't have the time on the road to get to the next gig, blah, 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 to go through that whole process. So what they used to do was bank $10,000 in six banks rather than one bank with $60,000. And I'll never forget this one afternoon, it's lunchtime in this little bank on a supermarket in a mile somewhere, and we went in and just put £10,000 with the slip, the paying in slip, and they said, "Could you just wait, please, sir? And could you just wait a bit longer, sir?" And 10-15 minutes later, the FBI walked in.
Oh, no.
And took us into the back room of the bank and started asking all these questions. They thought we were money laundering. And I didn't have it was very bizarre.
Luckily, you managed to talk your way out of that one. That's,
Yeah, they believed us, thank goodness.
oh, because, yeah, it must have looked so strange though from the outside looking in. But 10,000 here, 10,000 there. But it just shows, doesn't it, how different it was back then as well.
Yeah, everything's a little bit more long-winded.
Oh yeah, a lot longer. Yeah, I was mentioning Kate Bush. I got to see her, and of course, the last time she was on stage was in 1979.
Yes.
Please tell me to any stories you can about the time there with Kate Bush.
Where does one begin, really? It was an extraordinary tour for me, for a couple of reasons. I think the main reason was the camaraderie of everyone involved, and everyone sort of wanting to make it as big a success for Kate as one could, and the whole crew and the whole band party. There was about 20 crew and 20 in the band party. We obviously travelled separately, but came together each day, pretty much each day, to do a show. And there was this amazing family feel about it. And I think, it came from Kate because she was surrounded by her family on that tour as well. Mum and Dad were very often out on the road with us, along with her two brothers, one Paddy, who was in the band, and John, who was a business management part of the team. It took an extraordinary amount of time setting it up, not from my perspective per se. It was quite easy from my point of view. I introduced her to a sound company and to the sound engineer that went on to do the tour, taking Kate and one of her brothers to the Hammersmith Odeon. I remember to listen to a sound system that had been in there the previous night for a Nazareth concert, of all things.
Oh, okay.
But it was at that time a very up-to-date crisp sound system, run by a company called ML Executives, and it was the crew from The Who, who built up a production company based out at Shepperton Studios, and they had some really great kit, basically, in the sound system, and then there was a very long two-week dress production and dress rehearsal period where we rented the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park and set up the whole thing there, and just went through it time after time after time. Kate, having rehearsed the band previously, rehearsed her dances in separate rehearsal facilities. And it all coming together at the Rainbow. And I think that long rehearsal period was fairly unique, because, especially today, it gets very expensive having 40 people, working every day,
Yeah.
whether you're traveling or not. But it was just because the show at that time was so theatrical and different. There were a variety of different things we had to overcome. One being the capability of Kate to sing and dance at the same time.
Yeah.
And one of the great things coming out of that tour was the first time that a headset was ever used live, apart from in a TV studio. that was developed by this sound company with some help from some other Scottish sound techs from Edinburgh. But the other more sombre reason for my recollection of this tour was the death of our lighting designer, Billy Duffield, who was a dear friend of mine. And we called him very, very late in the day in onto the team to, because he was Cockney Rebel's lighting designer, he was Peter Gabriel's lighting designer, he was free at the time, and we had an issue in rehearsals of timing and getting the lights on time. And I got him in, and he pulled the whole thing together. And then, very, very unfortunately, did himself in a grave where he fell 20 foot down onto his head at the very first show.
Oh no.
Yeah, and lived for about 5 days on a life support machine before passing away. So, that was, again, I mean, you can imagine that all 40 of us were just numb.
Yeah, of course.
I think we basically all pulled together to pull off a very, very famous piece of rock history, really, in a theatrical 1977 Kate Bush European tour.
Yeah, and it is like you say, it is a piece of rock history, most definitely. That one of the bad things about this show is time goes by so quickly, and I'm just looking now, we've got about 5 minutes left. What I want to do is, I mentioned it in the introduction to this show, your website, Road Stories. I've got to say, this is an absolutely superb website. The way that it's laid out, the stories that you tell, you've got the audio, you've got video, you've got photographs, and you can zoom into the photographs. When did this website start? And obviously it's still ongoing as well, because the content is just, it seems endless. You can't go on this website for 10 minutes, because trust me, you'll end up on this website for like 2 hours. There's so much to see and listen to and to do. I feel like I'm bigging it up just because you're on the show now, but really, Richard, believe me, that it is a fantastic website. So please tell me and the listeners when it started, and a bit of the story about Road Stories.
Oh, thank you very much, Dave, for those kind words. I wanted to write an autobiography of the 70s and 80s from my perspective as a tour manager, and I didn't want to do the general book. I thought if I could try, with the internet going the way it was, to create some sort of more interactive musical side to it, that I'd have a go at creating a multimedia website. So I started off with a program on my Apple computer called iWeb, which unfortunately, they don't do anymore. But have you ever used iWeb?
I haven't. No.
So it's a very clever bit of kit, really, because what it enabled me to do in just setting up initially this whole concept of a multimedia website was it allowed you to just create a web page, and it was a drag and drop system. So you could literally drag an icon, a photograph, and very cleverly you could actually angle it, so you didn't have to put things in columns. You could just spread them across a page like a scrapbook. And yeah. I love this whole concept of a scrapbook, and then within the scrapbook, oh look, there's a story and an audio file there. And so I sort of built it a bit like we were talking earlier about Myst, you know, and just the interactivity of a web page. Mm-hmm. And But the problem was with iWeb, because I got it up and running and it worked perfectly on Apple computers, but it didn't work on a particularly well on an iPad, didn't work on a phone, and it definitely didn't work very well on PCs. So I started discussing with a variety of different web designers how I could replicate this concept that I'd come up with of a scrapbook sort of vibe for the pages. And a bunch of guys, young guys here in Taunton, where I'm based, came up with a great back end that let me build the pages, but I could put stuff where I wanted within the page. It still is a column, it still is three columns, so to speak, but it allowed me to put audio there or there. It allowed me to put pictures there or there. It allowed me to create a library or a photo album that would blow out of the screen, so to speak. So I could show people the original itineraries. You could flick through the weeks of a specific tour and just see how an itinerary was laid out and how we traveled, where we stayed, and the whole ethos of what a tour manager, you know, sets up and does. And you know, with YouTube being as amazing as it is nowadays, I couldn't believe how many of the actual concerts I'd done or the tours that I'd done, someone had filmed a show or a part of a show, so I could add those in and give the, you know, a whole feel of the tour as it was then.
That adds so much to it, doesn't it?
And so, yeah, so the whole ethos is being able to recollect the music and listen to me burbling on a little bit about this particular tour, this particular week, this particular set of photos, and I didn't realise actually how much of a squirrel I was. It was squirrel. All the itineraries and photos and stuff. And diaries. I suppose the main thing was it all started originally because I wanted to know how far I'd travelled, and I had this thing: how many times, you know, how many miles have I done? So I started an Excel sheet of 73 to 86. And then I started writing down from my diaries, because I've kept a diary the whole time, and kept the itineraries of where I was when. So I ended up creating a 14-year workbook that I then could check the mileage between each city across the year. And it went from there, really, because as I was looking through them, I'd recollected this story or that story, and it sort of grew out of that. And what I wanted to do is to stay alive. So instead of just a book and that's the end of it, I want the whole website to actually grow, and grow not from my perspective, because I've laid out my perspective, but I want to add in other people's perspective of what it's like. So I've got online to put up there now. I've got some interviews with a couple of the Supertramp guys, a couple of the Cockney Rebel guys, and plans to get, you know, a few more stories from a few more of the artists that were involved through that time period.
It is. I mean, like I say, this is one of the beauty of this site, is how it's still growing with all stories like this. And now there is this free content on the site and this premium content on the site, and it's quite apt that we're recording this. It's the day after Black Friday. Now, I've seen people fighting, literally fighting with each other to save a few pounds over a television or a phone or anything like this. For me, the bargain of the year is $7.99 for a year's subscription to this site. That's the Black Friday bargain right there. That's what I'm going to say.
Thank you very much, sir.
There, yeah. I can, and it's true. I really mean it. I think it's if you know you spend whatever on a pint and a packet of crisps, and you know if you're down south, you probably you know it costs you more than that. But for the sake of $7.99 a year, I can't. I just want to make it clear that the content you're going to get with the audio and with the video and with the stories, and you know obviously you've heard Richard talking to me and to give you a little flavour of some of the stuff that he's done with his life and the bands that he's worked with and the things that have happened. That's not even beginning to scratch the surface of what's on this website. It is really, really good and highly recommended. Oh, my headset fell off then. Whoops. Richard, before you go, we're in this social media age. What are the best ways that people can find and follow you online? Obviously, we've got the Road Stories website. What else is there that people can follow what you do, get in touch with you maybe?
Yeah, I think I've set up a Facebook page, a Road Stories Facebook page. Between the website and the Facebook page.
Well, I'll give links to those. I'll put them in the podcast notes. So, you know, whatever MP3 player of choice you're listening to this on, you can have a look and the links will be on there so you can find Richard online. It's been a pleasure. We've gone a little bit over the 60 minutes. We've bent the space-time continuum a little bit.
Sorry about that.
It's, you know what, I could sit here for another hour or two at least, easily. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure, Richard. It really has. Great stories and so lovely to chat with you.
Dave, thank you very much. And my best wishes to your wife, Tina, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. And as always, the alarm clock goes off far too early, even though we did squeeze an extra few minutes out of it, you know, and who can blame me when I'm listening to stories like that? Please, as we just said, follow Richard via his social media. Go to roadstories.co.uk, check out all the content there. Like I said, it's constantly being updated. Bookmark it, because it's a site to keep, that's for sure. You can follow me on Twitter at 60 Minutes With, that's with a 6 and a 0. And also on Facebook, facebook.com/60MinutesWith, again with a 6 and a 0. Still working on the website, and hopefully that will be up in the new year with all the content that we've done so far. I will be back again very soon with another interview show, will be the next one, closely followed by the monthly entertainment show with both myself, Stabby and Ramrod. So thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it, and I will see you again very, very soon.